You know, when you think about corporate security or like digital privacy, you probably picture something like a fortress. You imagine massive tech companies building these towering digital walls, digging deep cryptographic moats, all to keep their most valuable secrets locked away from the rest of us.
Right? The general public definitely operates under that assumption. I mean, there's this expectation of total impenetrable security once a company reaches a certain valuation.
Yeah, but then you realize that it really doesn't matter how thick those titanium walls are if the caterer accidentally props open the back door with a brick. Welcome to the deep dive. I was reading through this massive report that dropped today from Teakingame Media, capturing a completely wild 24-hour period across the tech and gaming sectors. And well, as I was looking through it, a very distinct pattern started to emerge.
It's a remarkably cohesive snapshot of a single day, honestly. What we're actually witnessing across all these seemingly disconnected stories is it's a collapse of the perimeter.
I love that phrasing. The overarching theme we're unpacking today is the illusion of control in the digital age. We are going to look at how massive entities, I mean, we're talking Rockstar, Sony, Cisco, Nintendo, and even everyday crypto users, all try and often fail to protect their most valuable secrets and assets.
Exactly. And by the end of this, you are going to see how the security chain is everywhere around you and how it fractures in the absolute last place you would expect.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with what has to be the most agonizing failure of control imaginable for a video game studio.
Oh, you mean the Rockstar game situation? We absolutely have to start with that.
We do, because Rockstar is like legendary for being secretive, especially regarding Grand Theft Auto 6. They guard their development cycle like state secrets. So when I saw a headline that a massive technical detail just slipped into the public domain, I assumed it was another high-profile server hack. But it wasn't hackers, it was their own lawyers.
Yeah, it's a staggering unforced error. Rockstar is currently involved in an employment tribunal in Edinburgh involving 34 laid-off Rockstar North employees. And in the process of litigating this routine labor dispute, Rockstar's legal team submitted a batch of confidential evidence.
Oh no.
Yeah, specifically, they submitted internal Discord conversations between their developers.
I assume those chat logs weren't properly redacted.
Not even close. Buried in those logs was the absolute confirmation of a 32-player format for GTA 6's online lobbies.
Wow.
And for context, you know, the player cap we've had in GTA V Online has been 30 players for over a decade.
That is just wild. It's like trying to keep a massive surprise party a secret for years, only to accidentally staple the receipt for the cake to a company-wide memo. But help me understand something here. I play a few games, but two extra players doesn't sound like an earth-shattering revelation. Why was this such a big deal?
Well, it comes down to the underlying mechanics, really.
Yeah.
Going from 30 to 32 players in the game as complex as Grand Theft Auto isn't just about, you know, adding two more bodies.
Yeah.
From a technical perspective, confirming that number suggests profound optimizations in their proprietary rage engine. It means they're tracking physics, traffic, explosions, and 32 chaotic human players seamlessly across a massively detailed virtual Vice City. And the moment Rockstar's lawyers realized what was in that document, I mean, sheer panic ensued in the courtroom.
Yeah, I read that they literally begged the judge to stop.
They desperately requested the judge to prevent this specific section from being read aloud in open court. They had to argue right on the spot that the multiplayer lobby structure is one of their most sensitive commercial assets.
That is so embarrassing.
It really is. Bloomberg's Jason Schreier actually summed it up perfectly. He noted, if even a simple number like player lobby capacity is this confidential, imagine what other information they're keeping locked down.
It really pulls back the curtain on how tight a lid they try to keep on the public narrative, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And this blunder actually has tangible legal implications, too. Industry analysts are already pointing out that if the court determines Rockstar failed to adequately protect its own highly sensitive data in its own legal filings, the laid-off employees suing them might actually have a stronger argument regarding company mismanagement.
Oh, wow. So they are struggling to hide their secrets in Scotland. But what blows my mind is that they are simultaneously struggling to advertise their game in Florida. Like, while this leak was happening, Rockstar was trying to finalize a field marketing contract in Miami Beach.
Right, because the game's Vice City is a direct mirror of Miami, so the marketing synergy is pretty obvious. They wanted a major real-world presence down there. They pitched a $3 to $4 million deal to advertise GTA 6 right on the beaches.
But the Miami Beach City Commission almost killed it. They barely approved it in a razor-thin 4-3 vote because the local government was apparently terrified of the game's anti-authority themes.
Yeah, they were really hesitant.
And the money is going to a great cause. I mean, it's funding the Flamingo Park soccer field, but the city put Rockstar in a marketing straitjacket from October 15th through the end of 2026. Rockstar is heavily restricted. They can only use the Roman numeral 6 and the words Vice City on beach umbrellas and chairs. They aren't even allowed to print the full Grand Theft Auto name in those public spaces.
Which is completely antithetical to Rockstar's usual playbook, you know? Historically, they are a company known for loud, provocative, just unavoidable advertising. You usually see massive billboards from them, not subtle beach chairs.
Right. But if they are forced to be subtle, doesn't that almost make it cooler?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, these extreme restrictions might actually be a massive gift to Rockstar.
Really? How so?
By forcing them to use discrete cryptic symbols, like just a lone VI on an umbrella, it completely transforms the campaign. It shifts from a standard corporate ad buy into a viral puzzle.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's heavily reminiscent of the covert alternate reality marketing tactics that were so popular in the early 2000s. People taking photos of mysterious logos on a beach and speculating online will generate far more organic curiosity than a traditional billboard ever could.
That is so true. The illusion of control really goes both ways. The city thinks they are controlling the game's cultural footprint, but they might just be amplifying its mystique. But hey, speaking of marketing voids, let's look at what happens when a company's total silence practically demands a leak. Let's talk about Snowy.
Yes, the Fair Game leak, also known internally as Project Espresso.
Right. I know Haven Studios, which is led by Jade Raymond, has had 3 years of absolute radio silence. The gaming community has been incredibly skeptical about what they are doing. And then suddenly, actual in-engine gameplay footage just appears online. But it didn't leak from a courtroom this time, did it?
No, not at all. This leaked via a playtest registration page on a platform called Player.gg. And the footage showed a highly ambitious competitive PvPvE, which is player versus environment heist shooter running on a PS5 Pro.
Okay, for anyone listening who doesn't play shooters, what does PvPvE actually look like in practice?
Right, so imagine teams of human players acting as hackers and thieves. They're competing against AI-controlled security forces, so that's the environment part, but they're also competing against each other to extract cargo.
Oh, so it's a multi-layered threat.
Exactly. It blends the tactical breaching of a game like Rainbow Six Siege with the heist mechanics of Payday. You have dynamic environments, physical infiltration tools, and complex hacking systems all happening at once.
That sounds intense. But I have to ask the cynical question here.
Go ahead.
Sony hasn't released any official info on the business model or the release date. They've given us nothing. Is this leak actually, you know, convenient for them? Could leaks act as a backdoor way to test the waters and gauge player excitement without the risk of an official, potentially disastrous marketing rollout?
It's a very astute question. And to understand why Sony might want a backdoor marketing test, you have to look at their recent track record. They just experienced a massive commercial failure with a game called Conquered.
That was a live service game, right?
Correct. For the listeners, a live service game is one designed to keep you playing and paying for years, like Fortnite or Destiny. The failure of Conquered essentially forced Sony to reconsider its entire live service strategy.
Right. They lost a lot of money there.
A ton.
Yeah.
So they are operating in a climate of extreme caution right now. If they did an official glossy marketing rollout for Fair Game, they might face immediate backlash from a cynical audience suffering from live service fatigue.
But a gritty, unofficial leak of raw gameplay feels different.
Exactly. It builds organic, grassroots hype. The audience feels like they discovered something forbidden, rather than being sold a product. Whether the leak was an intentional strategic move or a genuine accident, it filled a vacuum created by Sony's own corporate silence.
Man, a vacuum in marketing is one thing. It's embarrassing, maybe a little chaotic, but a vacuum in your actual network infrastructure? That is catastrophic. I want to shift gears to the Cisco firewall crisis, because this part of the report gave me absolute chills.
Yeah, we are moving into high-stakes digital security now. This is about as serious as it gets.
I saw that CISA, the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, revealed a vulnerability in Cisco firewalls. And the report mentioned it received a perfect 10 out of 10 CVSS score. What does that actually mean?
So CVSS is the common vulnerability scoring system. Think of it like the Richter scale for cyber attacks. Most bugs are a 4 or a 5, you know, a minor tremor. A 10 out of 10 means the building is already collapsing. It is the absolute nightmare scenario.
But how does a firewall, the exact piece of technology literally designed to keep hackers out, become a 10 out of 10 vulnerability?
The vulnerability, officially tracked as CVE 2026-2079, was found in the web interface of Cisco Secure FMC firewalls. It comes down to something called flawed input validation checks. Basically, the system fails to properly verify the data being sent to it.
Wait, let me see if I grasp this. Is an input validation check kind of like a bouncer at a club checking your ID? And this flaw means the attacker handed the bouncer a piece of paper with a computer virus scribbled on it, and instead of throwing them out, the bouncer's brain just froze and let them walk right in.
That is a phenomenal analogy, yes. By sending a specifically crafted malicious HTTP request, attackers bypass authentication entirely. And worse, they gain root-level access.
Meaning they don't just get into the lobby, they get the master keys to the entire building.
Precisely. Root-level access means they have total administrative control. They can disable antivirus software from inside the system, monitor traffic, and inject encryption malware across the entire organizational network.
Wow, so it's not someone picking the lock on your front door. It's the lock manufacturer accidentally mailing the master key to a syndicate of thieves.
And the syndicate of thieves actively exploiting this is the Russian Quelin ransomware group, specifically a cluster known as UAT-1988. And what makes Quelin so devastating is that they operate on a RAAS model, ransomware as a service.
I saw that term in the report, ransomware as a service. Does that mean cybercrime has a subscription model now?
It's essentially the franchising of cybercrime, yeah. Think of it like a malicious Uber platform. The core developers of the Quelin malware don't do the hacking themselves. They build the software and rent it out to independent affiliates.
You're kidding.
Nope. The affiliates use the Cisco vulnerability to break into networks, and when they extract a ransom, the platform developers take a 20% cut.
That is terrifyingly efficient. And if you are listening to this on your commute thinking, well, I don't own a Cisco server, why do I care? The impact here is massive. There are over 200 victims worldwide already, including major hospitals, financial institutions, and energy companies. The estimated financial damages are exceeding $80 million.
It's so severe that CISA actually set a hard deadline. They ordered all federal agencies to update their systems by September 12, 2026, which is the exact day this report was published. Because when the firewall itself is the vulnerability, your entire digital perimeter just evaporates. Security experts were advising organizations to literally sever their internet connections if they detected an intrusion.
Just pull the plug. Unbelievable. Okay, so Cisco is a perfect example of a highly technical structural failure. But here's where it gets really interesting. Hackers don't always need a perfect 10 out of 10 bug to destroy a fortress. Sometimes they just bypass the technology entirely and target the weakest link.
Right, you're talking about the human element, the supply chain.
Exactly. Let's look at the Trezor hardware wallet attack. For context, Trezor makes physical devices that hold cryptocurrency offline. They are explicitly designed to be unhackable by keeping your assets off the internet. So how did they get breached?
Well, the hackers didn't attack the Trezor device. They attacked Brevo, a third-party email provider that Trezor uses to send out its marketing newsletters.
The caterer with the brick.
Exactly. The hackers exploited an authentication bug in Brevo to breach Trezor's mailing account. This handed them direct access to an email list of 347,000 Trezor users. And the social engineering tactic they deployed next was just a masterclass in psychological manipulation.
I actually have the subject line of the email they sent right here. It read, "Urgent security alert, STM32 microcontroller entropy vulnerability."
That subject line is perfectly weaponized.
It sounds so intimidating. I don't even know what an STM32 microcontroller is, but if I saw that in my inbox, my heart would drop.
Which is exactly what they're counting on. What's fascinating and deeply ironic is that they used intimidating, highly technical jargon, like entropy vulnerability, to mask a very primitive phishing attempt.
Right, just a basic scam.
Exactly. The email claimed there was a critical hardware flaw that could expose the user's private keys. It urged them to click a link to download a firmware update, and to verify their identity, they just needed to enter their seed phrase.
And for anyone who doesn't hold crypto, a seed phrase is the ultimate master password. It's the string of words that can recover your entire wallet. Trezor's number one rule, plastered everywhere, is that they will never, ever ask for your seed phrase.
But fear overrides logic. The hackers know that most users won't understand the jargon, but they will recognize the tone of authority and urgency. Trezor's security team actually caught the breach incredibly fast, though. They blocked the phishing domain at the DNS level in just 20 minutes.
Explain DNS blocking real quick for us.
Sure. So DNS is basically the phone book of the internet. Blocking it at the DNS level means they ripped down the street signs pointing to the fake website, so user traffic couldn't find it anymore. But even in that tiny 20-minute window, 2,500 users still clicked the link.
It's a stark reminder for all of us. Think about the apps on your phone right now. You can have biometric locks and two-factor authentication, but if that app relies on a third-party service that gets compromised, they have a direct line to your inbox.
The security chain is truly only as strong as the most vulnerable third-party vendor.
We've spent a lot of time talking about how attackers exploit supply chains and human psychology today. To close out our deep dive, I want to look at a story where a massive company actually successfully struck back at a vulnerability. Let's talk about Nintendo.
This is a landmark legal case out of the Netherlands. The District Court of The Hague handed Nintendo a major victory against the distributors of devices known as the MIG Switch and the MIG Switch Dumper.
These are those little hardware cartridges, usually costing between $60 and $100, right? And they essentially bypass the security locks on the Nintendo Switch console so you can play illegally downloaded games. But what really stood out to me in the report is how modern hardware piracy operates. It's not a guy on a street corner selling burned discs anymore.
Oh, not at all. Modern piracy has adopted the exact same e-commerce tactics as legitimate retail. We are talking about drop shipping networks.
Drop shipping? That's usually the side hustle you see advertised on social media for selling cheap phone cases or water bottles. How does it work for illegal tech?
Well, in a traditional retail model, a store buys inventory, holds it in a warehouse, and ships it to you. In drop shipping, the seller never touches the product. You buy the MIG switch from a website in Europe, and that website simply routes your order to a factory in Asia, which ships it directly to your door.
Got it. So the seller is just a digital middleman.
Exactly.
Which must make tracking them down an absolute nightmare for a company like Nintendo.
Historically, companies would play an endless game of whack-a-mole. If they shut down a torrent site, a mirror site would pop up in Russia an hour later. If they sued an individual downloading games, it generated terrible PR and recovered $0. But what's fascinating here is Nintendo's legal pivot.
What did they do differently?
They didn't target the end user, and they didn't try to find the overseas factory. They targeted the drop shipping logistics network itself.
They went after the middleman's infrastructure.
Yes. The court ruled that the primary function of these devices was to circumvent DMCA protection, which is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that prohibits breaking digital locks. The dropshippers were ordered to cease all advertising, immediately block their internet domains, and pay millions of euros in damages to Nintendo. By targeting the distribution infrastructure, Nintendo severed the artery.
And the Tekken Game report notes this is going to have massive long-term industry impacts. Sony and Microsoft deal with the exact same hardware piracy threats. They are absolutely going to cite this Netherlands ruling as a legal precedent to hunt down dropshippers globally.
It really sets a new standard. In the digital age, the most effective way to protect software is to aggressively dismantle the physical movement of the hardware.
So, what does this all mean? If we step back and look at this entire report, whether you are a gamer waiting for GTA 6, or a crypto investor guarding your seed phrase, or an IT worker frantically patching a hospital's firewall, you are an active participant in this constant war over digital secrets. The perimeter isn't just a wall, it's a living ecosystem. And as we've seen today, it can break in a Scottish courtroom, it can break on a third-party marketing server, or it can be dismantled in an international dropshipping network.
The illusion of control is exactly that, an illusion. The vulnerabilities are always shifting.
But it leaves you with this provocative thought to mull over. We just saw how massive companies like Nintendo are getting incredibly efficient at using the legal system to destroy global digital distribution networks. And at the exact same time, we see how fragile the internet is when a 10 out of 10 zero-day exploit can shut down a hospital. So, as the digital walls get both more heavily policed by corporations and simultaneously more dangerous due to hackers, will we eventually see a resurgence of analog piracy? Are we going to go back to localized face-to-face exchanges of data, people passing physical thumb drives to each other in coffee shops, just like the early offline days of computing? Because when the digital fortress fails, maybe we just stop using the fortress altogether.
That is a compelling and highly plausible vision of the future.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the walls around your data. We'll catch you next time.